It's the Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. With a key election year here and a new census to get underway, the city's first diversity and inclusion policy analyst has joined the Pittsburgh chapter of the NAACP as executive director to help make the organization look to the future. Kelly Ware Sebron, welcome to the Confluence.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Pittsburgh's branch of the NAACP has not had an executive director for some years, with the position being vacant for a while. What was the direction given to you by the board?
To work closely with them to modernize and kind of just take things forward for the organization.
Anything specific about taking the organization forward, though?
Not necessarily. Kind of looking towards our past for direction, also working closely with National. There are 6 National Game Changers that they have in mind that we work closely with National to advance those things on a local level.
So give me one for an example where you say, this is a National Game Changer. How do we want to implement this locally for Pittsburgh?
So the first thing would be the national emphasis on voter registration. Mm-hmm. And representation. So that in and of itself is voter registration, voter education, and then census completion. So that's obviously something that we would be working on locally.
Right. You've only been on the job about five weeks or so. But what have you been hearing from community members? What do they want from the Pittsburgh chapter? What are their aspirations for the Pittsburgh chapter?
What I've been hearing is really they just want to see us more active, more involved, kind of leading from the front a little bit more than we have been maybe in years past. Mm-hmm. And just to get folks involved with the chapter. So that's what I've been mostly hearing.
Does that include recruiting for more people to be members of the chapter?
Yes, we are definitely in the middle of a membership drive. Yes.
As City Council's first diversity and inclusion policy analyst, were there limitations on what you could do, what local government can do?
Absolutely. So there are definitely limitations on what I could do, both as this working for the city and then working for City Council specifically. So there are a number of equity issues that directly impact people, especially Black and Brown folks in the city of Pittsburgh, that the city government has absolutely no control over, mm-hmm. such as the quality of education. There's a completely separate school board for that, such as education access. Transportation access.
Right.
That's a county authority.
Port authority,
right,
yes.
That's the port authority of Allegheny County. Then there's any variety of things that actually impact people. The city can give out incentives for job creation or for employers to locate here, but that doesn't necessarily create equity in the jobs themselves, right?
Right.
And so all of those things that directly impact equity are things that I was not in any position to do anything about, and even my bosses weren't necessarily in a position to do anything about.
But were you able to at least work closely with those entities, whether it's the Port Authority of Allegheny County, whether it's the Pittsburgh School Board, or someone that has more direct control over an issue that is of concern?
I hadn't been there for very long, but no, I wasn't able to really make those connections work very well.
Did you feel that policy and ordinances can only go so far to address the challenges, even in the inequities that you're trying to tackle?
Yes.
In other words, government can only do so much, true or false?
Oh, I'm a lawyer, so I hate true or false questions. I'm always a it depends kind of girl. But I guess if those being the options that I was given, I would say that it is true that there are limitations to what government can do in terms of anything, really. A well-worded ordinance can get you 75% of the way there. Mm-hmm. Even if it's something like equal opportunity review, you can write it with all the teeth in the world, but then there's always kind of a way to wiggle out of, well, we did everything we could, but we still couldn't find any Black contractors. Mm-hmm. So there's still always going to be an area where you can kind of wiggle out of even the best intended legislation. Right. However, I do think that I'm sorry, I think I'm bumping the table. But however, I do think that it does go a long way to show right. the goal and where you're trying right. to get to. And public pressure from our electeds, I do think, can certainly go a long way.
So how will this position be different, whether it's to sort of, you know, help toward that goal?
Okay. So I think that this position will be different in that if it affects equity or the lack of equity in the city, if whether it's education, whether it's transportation, whether it's an individual business who is either doing bad practices or hiring or not hiring or pay gaps, if it's something is pretty much if it runs the gamut, the NAACP can make a statement or about it. We can also still work with local policymakers on policy, but then we also have that kind of carrot and stick, I think, is part of what drew me to the NAACP, is that we have the carrot of, hey, if you do well, we will praise you and we will work with you and we'll help you with your policy, so on and so forth. And then there's also that stick that is we can also show up and rally and scream and holler in front of your business or what have you if you're a wrong actor. So I think that kind of dual role and being in a leadership position in that dual role is very exciting and would take me beyond what I was able to do as a policy analyst.
So how much weight do statements carry in general?
I think it depends on both the statement and what you're making a statement on. So the statement itself, I think, can be strong or not. And then depending on what your statement is regarding, I think that our statement on Judge Tranquilli was well received.
Right. Of course, the judge had made remarks that have been deemed by some as racist remarks in chambers to a defense attorney and a prosecutor.
Absolutely. And so I think that our statement added a little bit to what was in the conversation at that point. And so that made it perhaps a bit more of a powerful statement.
Right. Yeah. Kelly Ware Sebron is the new executive director of the Pittsburgh chapter of the NAACP. Yours is an appointed position. Pittsburgh's NAACP president, Richard Stewart, is elected by the membership. How do you, as executive director and the president, work together to develop goals and take action to achieve them?
I talk to President Stewart almost every day, a couple of times a week for sure. It's an appearance that has to do with the NAACP more than kind of a profile piece, then we do those together. We work hand in hand to accomplish the goals. Obviously, the board has a broader, more governance scope, whereas I'm a little bit more operational as a leadership staff on the day to day.
Well, let's take a look at some of those short term goals then. What are you prioritizing these first weeks, these first months, this year?
Couple of months will be spent kind of modernizing our systems. We got some new computers just this past week. We're modernizing the office, getting our social media active, more activated, all of those sorts of things. The low-hanging fruit that is very time-sensitive is obviously the census and voter registration, and those are the things that we need to take care of kind of in this spring and summer.
Well, let's talk a little bit about the census. Back in December, the Census Bureau released some new estimates. It said the city of Pittsburgh's population was stable, but that between 2014 and 2018, the city lost 7,000 African-American residents. What does that tell you? What does that say?
So that tells, for me personally, having grown up in East Liberty, I left for 4 years to go to law school in Boston. I returned and even as a lawyer was priced out of the neighborhood that I grew up in. And I know people that fared far worse than myself, who were similarly priced out of different neighborhoods. And I think that that's where the city is seeing a lot of population loss, especially in the Black community, is people being pushed out to other areas. I'm a city girl at heart. I wanted my kid, I'm a city girl at heart, so I wasn't going to move to Penn Hills. But I know a lot of my friends that did. And I know a lot of people that were in public housing that was torn down and not replaced on a one-for-one basis that when the time came for them to be relocated, wound up in Pitcairn and other further-flung suburbs. And I think that's where we're seeing a lot of the population loss.
Is it a matter of economics? Do you feel that some Black residents are giving up on the city?
Oh, I think it's definitely both and. You read report after report. I mean, Dr. Howell said from the mayor's podium,
right,
essentially, if you're Black in the city of Pittsburgh, you could just move anywhere else and live a better quality of life. So that is obviously disheartening. It's like, oh, so what you're saying is that maybe it's not worth the fight and I should just go and be more productive elsewhere. Obviously, that's not my opinion. I'm here to fight for the city because I believe in it and what it can be. But it's also disheartening. So I can see why a number of people would also just give up and go to other places.
Mm-hmm. Just about 2 minutes left. The Peduto administration introduced an economic development team earlier this year. What can you do? What should be done to make development more equitable throughout the city?
I think there are a number of things that are already in progress. I think that there's just definitely needs to be a greater collaboration with community voices. I think that it's one thing to read a study, but it's another thing to live the study. And then are people, of course, that have done both. And I would definitely say I believe that the work that Diamante Walker is doing over at the URA is transformational. And I think that if they listen to some of the directions that she's pushing things in, as somebody who, again, right, Black woman in the city who is living and familiar with the studies, that they will really be moving forward in the right direction.
Deputy Director of URA.
Yes.
Right. So, briefly, I know you're familiar with the all-in concept as,
yes,
an all-in city. What does that mean for you, and what will it take for Pittsburgh to truly be an all-in city?
Well, the concept, I think, means that we are on board with issues of racial equity, economic equity, and diversity and inclusion. I think what it will take and what it will for us to truly be an all-in city is to really dive down on that and ask ourselves some of the difficult questions, ask about some of the people who have been, some people and institutions that have been takers, to give more. And I think that that would be first step.
Are you an optimist when it comes to Pittsburgh being all in?
Yes. I would say that there are people who are probably more optimistic than I am, but sure, I would call myself on the optimistic camp.
Kelly Ware-Sebron is the executive director of the Pittsburgh chapter of the NAACP. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
I'm Kevin Gavin. You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA.
The Confluence airs weekday mornings from 9 to 10, but the news never stops. Find stories, conversations, and full episodes on our website at wesa.fm/confluence, on Twitter at wesaconfluence, and wherever you get your podcasts. The Confluence continues next on 90.5 WESA.
I'm Katie Blackley with the Pittsburgh Almanac. This week in history, one of the country's first African-American female pharmacists, Ella P. Stewart, is born in 1893. Stewart grew up in Virginia and was the top of her class, entering what would become Storer College at the age of 12. While in the school, she met and married her husband, and the two moved to Pittsburgh. She worked at a local pharmacy as a bookkeeper before going on to gain admission to the University of Pittsburgh School of Pharmacy in 1914. She was the first Black woman to graduate from the program and was the first to get her state license. She would go on to open her own pharmacy in Ohio several years later. That's today's Pittsburgh Almanac.
WYEP celebrates Women's History Month throughout March. Today, find out about Betty Wright. A singer who has made a name for herself in R&B and soul music, Betty Wright hit the pop top 40 while she was still in high school. And she had her biggest mainstream success at age 17 with the top 10 single Clean Up Woman in 1971. Just making it easy for the clean up woman. She continued having R&B hits through the 1970s and 80s. After the turn of the century, Betty Wright raised her profile once again with a series of collaborations, including co-producing and singing backing vocals for much of the first two albums by UK singer Joss Stone. She also recorded singles with Angie Stone, DJ Khalid, and a collaborative album with The Roots. In the middle of the game, don't change the play. To hear full songs from all of our featured artists for Women's History Month, go to WYEP.org/women.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. In the past 10 years, more than 500,000 refugees have been resettled across the United States. Two cities in Pennsylvania are ranked among the top 10 in terms of per capita refugee resettlement. It's a hot-button issue right now as the Trump administration wants to grant local governments the option to refuse refugees. But how is the issue playing out in communities most impacted?
We appreciate immigrants, but coming into the country illegally isn't the way to do it.
When I came here, it was like, wow, there was so much diversity. I feel like I belong.
If they're willing to come in and support my business, that's great.
Producer Andrea Tudhope of America Amplified Election 2020 spent time with residents of Clarkston, Georgia, a small town that resettles the highest number of refugees per capita each year.
It's a Tuesday afternoon at the nonprofit Friends of Refugees. More than a dozen people from Ethiopia, Syria, Central America have come to find work. Volunteer James McNeely is checking people in at the front door.
Get an appointment? Okay.
McNeely remembers a very different Clarkston 30 years ago.
It was your typical southern small town.
Since then, nearly 40,000 refugees have come through Georgia. And for most, Clarkston was the first stop. With affordable multifamily housing left vacant by white flight and easy access to public transportation into Atlanta, federal resettlement agencies took notice. It's a tiny town, at most 2 square miles, so you can really see the impact. Within a few yards of the heart of the town, there's a Nepalese restaurant, an African food mart, halal meat, an Eritrean cafe, and a Vietnamese gift shop.
The whole city was a lot of American businesses. If you drive around now, you're not going to see. I'm one of the few left.
When Bill Mellinger bought Thrifttown Market in the 90s, he tried running it like a typical American grocery, and he almost went bankrupt. Then he hired a cashier from Vietnam, and she helped him find products her family wanted to buy.
Pretty soon we had a really booming little Asian business in the store.
Now the shelves are filled with brands from all over the world. It was a gradual and difficult change, one Mellinger says many others weren't willing to make.
A lot of the people just either decided to get up and go or they didn't change and they got left behind.
Many longtime residents of the small town felt uncomfortable with the changes. Some told me all things are better in moderation and that Clarkston overdid it. Immigrant Edna Soliman felt a similar discomfort when she first came here from the Philippines.
I was sad when I was new here. It's my first time to meet a lot of people, especially from Africa.
The challenge lies in eliminating this fear of the unknown among longtime residents and newcomers. Sushma Barakoti is with the advocacy group Refugee Women's Network.
As is, the immigrant communities live in silos. We should be integrating and working together.
Those silos came as a result of rapid change. 2009 saw the local population shoot up nearly 60% to the roughly 13,000 residents it holds now. That's the year Amina Osman arrived. She remembers feeling unwelcome.
It was a nightmare. I did not know where to start.
Hearing her describe it as a nightmare is even more haunting when you know the nightmare she fled from in Somalia in 1998 when her husband and all of her children were killed in front of her during the Civil War. A decade later, arriving in Georgia, she made it her mission to bridge divides in the community. She quickly became known around town as Mama Clarkston.
I want to be around people. I don't see somebody is not feeling well because of me or other refugees.
She appreciates the work of some local advocacy groups, but she worries about exploitation. It does feel like refugees have become somewhat of an industry for the small town's economy. Meanwhile, there's a lot of uncertainty in the refugee community. Georgia Governor Brian Kemp is one of only 7 governors in the country who, in response to the Trump administration's order, has yet to consent to continue resettlement. But with constant construction underway, by all appearances, this so-called Ellis Island of the South continues to grow. In Clarkston, Georgia, I'm Andrea Tudhope, and this is America Amplified.
America Amplified is a public media collaboration by 90.5 WESA and other stations across the U.S. It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Admit it. Have you ever had a library book that was overdue? You missed the return date and you hesitated to go to the library, not just because the fine was overwhelming, but maybe, just maybe, a little embarrassment. The Allegheny County Library Association has joined a growing trend of libraries that are eliminating fines altogether. Marilyn Jenkins is the executive director of the Allegheny County Library Association, a federation of 46 different public libraries. Marilyn, welcome to the Confluence.
Well, thank you. I'm glad to be here.
Most libraries still fine people for holding on to books longer than they were supposed to. Why did the County Library Association want to join other libraries, whether it's Columbus, Chicago, San Francisco, and eliminate that punishment, so to speak?
It's all about access. We believe that public libraries are there for everyone in the community, and we want to remove as many barriers as possible.
Is one of those barriers the financial consideration itself?
Sometimes it can be. Certain families are obviously not in a position to be able to worry about having to pay extra fines for their children's items or their own items. And again, we don't think that should be a reason why people can't use public libraries.
I have to ask you, what's the largest fine that you ever encountered or heard of?
Fines don't tend to accrue that much. It's if you don't return your books, you'll get billed for them. And we've had people owing as much as $3,500 or more.
$3,500?
That's correct.
Hmm.
And that's what we don't want to see, is we believe the materials belong to the public, but not to every individual who wants to keep them forever.
We hear the stories about speed traps on some roads with the traffic fines helping going to a small town's coffers. How much does any library in your group take in from fines? Is it enough to affect your finances?
It's a really small percentage as a general rule. Fines themselves are usually less than a couple percent of the revenue. Lost books can consume more, but we're not removing those charges.
Right. And the lost books you have to replace,
exactly.
You want to replace, so it's available for your other customers.
Yes.
To be clear, this is a pilot program, right?
That's correct.
How many of the 46 organizations that are a part of the County Library Association are participating, and when did it begin?
Well, right now there are 14 libraries participating. The first wave of libraries began in October. And then three branches of the Carnegie Library of Pittsburgh joined a month later. And then in January, two more libraries from the county joined.
All right. So three branches from Carnegie Library of mm-hmm. Pittsburgh. So not the whole system itself.
That's correct. They're piloting it internally as well.
Where did the idea to try this model come from? Was it something from the top down, from you, from your patrons? Why did you even want to consider this?
It actually came from library staff who recognize how much time it takes to collect fines, the amount of staff resources that go into that, as well as the issues they were encountering at the desk. You know, we don't want people coming to public libraries and having a negative experience. They can go someplace else and do that. In public libraries, we want them to feel welcome. And we found in many situations that fines were one of those barriers and were causing issues at the circulation desk.
We're talking to Marilyn Jenkins, executive director of the Allegheny County Library Association. Have you received any criticism so far in this pilot program?
I think there are libraries that are hesitant to test this out. So they're waiting to see how it goes with the pilot libraries. I think some members of the public are concerned that this may encourage people not to bring back their items. But in fact, none of the data supports that.
Do you think it's mostly, I just plain forgot?
Well, it can be plain forgot. It could be, although not this winter. Sometimes it's a snowstorm and you didn't get back to the library. And you know, librarians have been very generous throughout the years, understanding particular situations and personal issues. And so many librarians have already been waiving fines pretty consistently.
Aside from the actual cost of the fines, is there a hesitancy to show up at the library with that overdue book? Maybe a bit of embarrassment.
Yes, I think sometimes there is an element of shame. And we certainly don't want people feeling that. We don't want them not coming to the library because they owe some money on some materials from 5 years ago or something, and they were so embarrassed they didn't want to come back. So I think what we're trying to do is, again, just remove that barrier.
it could affect not just them, but maybe family members?
Yes, often it has to do with children because, I don't know, my kids were, they had a tendency to lose things on occasion and forget that they had to get them back, whether it was homework or library books. Right. So the parents then are put in a position of having to account for those books. So I think it can become a whole family issue.
Right. You don't want to deny the kids a wonderful community resource.
Right.
The pilot program has been going on now for about 5 months. What have you seen so far? Is it anecdotal data, or do you have something that you're really keeping track of?
Well, they're actually tracking a number of things. They're tracking whether or not items are returning on a regular basis. And in fact, the data seems to show that there isn't a change in how long people are holding items out. So that's a good thing. We've also noticed that people are incredibly happy. They come and they think they owe, oh my goodness, I might have to owe $2 or something in fines. They find out that they don't. They're so grateful, sometimes they put a $5 bill in the jar on the desk.
Do you think it's encouraged new customers? Is that lifting a fine sort of an encouragement for more people to sign up and get that library card?
That, in fact, is another data point that they're tracking. And in one of our libraries, they've seen a tremendous increase in the number of new cardholders. And that's exactly what we want to see.
Can you track that directly to the elimination, or there's some other factors that say, you know, I recognize that the library is an important resource for me?
I think it's a combination of factors, but the fact that they don't have that barrier makes it even more likely that people are going to come in. I think, you know, people advertise word of mouth. If you had good service at a restaurant, you tell people, and that brings other people into that restaurant. The same is true about libraries. If the customer experiences good service, they're likely to come back.
So how long is the pilot project going to last, and then what?
Well, I think in this case, either 6 months or a year, the libraries that are participating want to track data over that period of time. But the initial libraries have already indicated that this has been so successful that they're going to continue on. So I would anticipate more libraries are likely to join in.
So therefore, it's an individual choice by each library, each of the 46, rather than sort of a top-down edict from the Allegheny County Library Association?
That's correct. We have 46 independently operated libraries. They respond to their own communities, and so each one of them will be making a decision.
What's your guess? Do you think it'll be pretty widespread, or what do you think?
If I look nationally and we see places like Columbus and San Francisco and Chicago and Enoch Pratt in Baltimore, I just see this becoming more and more of a trend. And I think it's due. It's time for this kind of reconsideration of a punitive measure that we've had.
Marilyn Jenkins is the executive director of the Allegheny County Library Association. Thanks, Marilyn.
Thank you, and please encourage everyone to come visit their library.
And for today, that is The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. You can find us online anytime at wesa.fm/confluence. This and every episode of the program is available via podcast. Download, rate, and review us wherever you tune in. Today's program was engineered and produced by Kylie Kaczynski. Production assistance from Caroline Burke. The editor and producer of The Confluence is Megan Harris. Happy birthday, Megan. I'm Kevin Gavin. Until next time, hope you have a good day of good news.